All right, joining us today, we have senior national political reporter for NBC News, but more importantly, a Youngstown native and my old editor-in-chief at the Jam Bar, Mr. Henry Gomez. Henry, how you been, man?
I'm doing great, BJ. How about you?
Good, man. Thanks so much for coming on today, man. Really appreciate it.
Of course, of course. Yeah, excited to do it. Love talking to all my friends in the Valley.
Nice, man. So, you know, as long as I've known you, you've wanted to be a political reporter. I mean, from the first time I met you, like that was sort of what you aspired to be. And you're there now, obviously, with NBC News. And you've had a lot of stops kind of along the way. But, you know, kind of describe your journey from Youngstown State to where you are now.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were there at the beginning, us in the Jam Bar newsroom on the campus of YSU. And I was a political science major first, so I thought I'd maybe go into politics. And then, as you remember, we had a pretty great teacher, professor, mentor, Alyssa Lenhoff, who, you know, dragged us all into the into the world of journalism. And honestly, very fortunate to have somebody like her in my life early on. You know, pushing me and championing me and cheering me on. And you know, I took a news writing course with Alyssa. I think it was my sophomore year. And YSU, when we were there, I think at first they didn't, BJ, have a official journalism major from what I remember. You had to kind of cobble it together with professional writing and editing courses. And, you know, but Alyssa was trying to get it accredited as an official, you know, journalism major. And as she was doing that, you know, I had a course with her, and she was really encouraging me to, you know, add this new journalism major as a double major. So I ended up doing both, and you and I ended up working on the Jam Bar together. And I worked at the Tribune Chronicle in Warren while I was still at YSU. I'd work days, I'd do my classes and my Jam Bar stuff during the day, and then I'd go to Warren at night and do my copy editing shift at the Tribune Chronicle. So it was, that's what really planted the seed, having good teachers, having, you know, good experiences at YSU. And really, you know, growing up in Youngstown and Mahoning Valley just had such a colorful cast of political characters that I think that's kind of what, you know, piqued my interest in politics at a young age.
Nice, man. You know, what are some of your fondest memories of YSU? I mean, I remember obviously working at the Jam Bar a whole lot with you. I remember also leaving the Jam Bar. I remember a lot of day drinking in Inner Circle, like depending on when we got done or, you know, and that sort of thing. But it was a fun place then. And I remember correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you and I were the first to graduate with a journalism degree. Like when they officially had the program, we were among the first people to graduate with that degree.
Yeah, that's right. That's how I remember it. I mean, it was like 2003 is when the first like graduates of that program started coming through. And, but I mean, yeah, just so many great memories. I mean, we really, you know, the Jam Bar was an institution, still is at Youngstown State, had been around for so long. And I remember, you know, not like a knock on previous regimes who edited the Jam Bar, but I just remember that, like, you know, starting in the years before you and I, you know, were in charge, and, you know, I think coinciding with, you know, some of those, you know, last years with Dale Harrison, who was a journalism professor, and then Alyssa coming on, you know, the Jam Bar really started, you know, kicking ass and taking you know, administration to task on everything from like pay raises to, I mean, there were all sorts of issues going on. I mean, it was back when there was like dispute over whether or not you could offer benefits to like domestic partners. These are things that were going on, you know, 20 years ago now, and kind of set up a lot of the debates and arguments we still have today on some level. But we had a good time just sort of, you know, we were young and didn't really care about access or favor or anything like that. And I think we gave the administration good trouble and, you know, forced them to respect us and deal with us and, you know, play by our rules, which was fun. And, but yeah, I mean, I too remember the days at Inner Circle and, you know, just staying late to put the paper to bed, you know, figuring out which beer we were going to have when it was all over. And those were some of the best times I've had in journalism, you know, to this day.
Yeah, we definitely pissed off the administration something fierce a couple times, I remember. And I like we were, like you said, it was just sort of like a kind of a PR piece sort of before those years that we were kind of there. And I just, yeah, I just remember them being angry at us for a number of things, or not even angry, but just kind of annoyed. It was like, all right, we really have to kind of take this. We need to take these, you know, we need to take this paper seriously now.
Yeah, when I graduated, I remember I had a source slash friend who worked in the president's office at YSU, and she told me how one of the president's assistants walked by her the day that they were stuffing the diplomas and said, "Which one's Henry Gomez's? I want to spill coffee on it." So I wore that as a badge of honor. That was that's a fun story to hear after I walk on the stage.
Nice, man. Nice. So, you know, you and I. Of the years and stuff that we were at YSU, when you and I were probably a couple of the first to sort of dive right into the journalism profession. I was in it daily until a year ago, but it set me up for the job that I have now. But you know, kind of speaking to that, what would your advice be to you know, aspiring journalists that are just kind of getting into it today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if this is something you want to get into. I mean, a lot has changed about the industry since you and I graduated. I mean, there's been so much contraction in terms of, like, you know, daily newspapers that either are much smaller or don't exist anymore. You know, I worked for BuzzFeed before I came to NBC. You know, when I left, it was still, you know, alive and kicking. Their news division was great, you know, but they no longer have, you know, a standalone news division. So I guess my advice would be, you know, be open-minded about where you start. Don't hesitate to take jobs that, you know, they may not be your first choice. They may not be the thing that you ultimately want to do, but, you know, you demonstrate your value and your worth to people, at least in terms of your worth to people, what you can offer as a journalist or a reporter or a designer or whatever, by doing those things that maybe nobody else wants to do. I was at the Tribune at nights as a copy editor, which was something I had absolutely no experience doing, but they were desperate for people to, you know, come proofread their stories at night and write headlines. You know, it was like a minimum wage job when I took it. You know, they knew I had no experience, so it's not like they were going to offer me any more than that, but it was great experience. I learned a ton. You know, eventually got to do more reporting. The more they learned to trust me. It was kind of the same thing after I graduated. The first job I took was at a business publication in Cleveland. I didn't want to be a business reporter. I was horrible at math. I was horrible at personal finance. You know, I didn't know, you know, how to read an SEC report. And so this business magazine in Cleveland that I applied to just basically because I needed a job, they interviewed me. They asked me, you know, do you have experience reading SEC reports? I'm like, no, but I'm willing to learn. I thought for sure I wouldn't get that job. They hired me. And then that was my first job then at the plane dealer in Cleveland, where I worked for a long time, was as a business reporter. You know, you gradually work your way up. You show people that you can handle the tasks that are thrown at you, and they'll trust you with more. And then just in terms of, like, the job search, I mean, you got to be aggressive. You got to bug people. You know, I hate to use the word networking because it's such a buzzword, and I personally, you know, hate doing that sort of thing. But, you know, the more people you meet, ask them to look out for you, you know, ask them to, if they see something that might fit, you know, your talents, that they'll keep you in mind, give you a call, bug them every once in a while, just to see if something's popped up that maybe they weren't thinking about you for. I just think that a good journalist, a good reporter is persistent. And so there's no shame in showing that persistence and erring on the side of bothering somebody too much.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of misconceptions out there and that I would run into with, you know, kids coming out of college or even out of high school when they think about journalism is, you know, they kind of want the job at ESPN or Entertainment Tonight or something, like, right out of school. And that's not how it works unless you're, like, you know, unless you're a star athlete that just retired, you're not, you know what I mean? You're not going to be jumping right into these sort of jobs. Like it takes time, and you have to kind of, you know, you have to work your way up, and those jobs are so few and far between. So yeah, I just remember like just telling people kind of what you said too. It just you got to kind of dive in head first, and you do have to do. You're going to spend a lot of time doing jobs that you're not necessarily super happy with to get where you kind of want to go. And it's just kind of telling these kids like stick with it, and it will pay off if you keep working hard. But it is a bit of a long road and a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that social media has changed it a little bit, or changed it a lot for a while. I think we might start to see that reverting back. Like, I mean, having like a quote unquote brand on Twitter or Instagram or now TikTok could be a shortcut to like developing an audience. Or we're seeing a lot of people today go like independently, like with a Substack or with you know podcasts or whatever. You don't have to be like a staff writer at some like well-known institution to get your name out there. I do think that like if you want people to take you seriously and get noticed, you've got to like put in that work. You can't just be throwing up a bunch of crazy snaps with like trap music in the background or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like you do, but there are ways to like get your voice out there and to show like your talents without having the platform of like an NBC News or an ESPN, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get into politics a little bit without getting sort of too into the woods or kind of inside baseball and stuff, because I'm not, full disclosure, I don't follow politics probably as much as I should. I will kind of on the local level and stuff around here, but when it gets to the national stuff, it gets kind of hard to sort of decipher what's real, what isn't real. There's a lot of misinformation kind of out and about there, especially if you're coming across a lot of things on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or X or whatever it is. What's kind of your advice for the average person that's to find kind of a reliable news sources that they can trust? I think there's this big mistrust with the media, and that's kind of a blanket sort of statement, but you hear people say they don't trust the media. I guess what would your advice be to those folks to kind of try to find those sources that are reliable and that aren't biased?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a couple things here. I think that like, unfortunately, there's been a lot of work done over the last 10 years or more to discredit mainstream journalism or journalism in general. And it's not helpful when you have a lot of people crying fake news whenever there's a story they don't happen to agree with or they don't like or don't want you to read. But of course, there are news sources everywhere. There are reporters everywhere who might bring in their personal biases to what they're covering. My advice is, people are smart enough. People should be smart enough to discern like what's legit and what's not. I mean, I do think that for all the criticism that the New York Times or NBC or ABC or like these mainstream outlets get, whether it's your local paper or whether it's like the network that you watch, these are organizations that pay an incredible amount of money to people to get it right and to research the facts and to present them in an unbiased way. I think that you could trust what you're reading on most of those sites. Now, again, we should all have, and some of us have better, bullshit detectors than most. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Be well-rounded in what you read. I mean, don't just, the biggest problem right now is what's called like motivated reasoning. People will go online or on TV or radio or whatever, and they will seek out only the opinions that reinforce their own. So if you're somebody that already leans right, you are watching Fox News at night because it reinforced the primetime lineup reinforces what you already think. If you're somebody that, leans to the left, you might be listening to those types of podcasts because they reinforce what you're already thinking. It's fine. Like I follow the Cleveland Guardian, so I listen to a Guardian's podcast every morning. But like I, know that, those hosts might have bias toward a certain player. So I'm taking what they say with a grain of salt. I'm also reading a lot of other content or news about the Guardians because I want to make sure that like my own point of view is well-rounded and informed.
Mm-hmm. Actually, getting into the upcoming election a little bit, and again, this is coming from somebody that doesn't follow politics a whole lot, but I think I feel the way a lot of people do. Why don't we have any other options? Why is it these two guys again?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think that 20 earlier questions, like a lot of people are skeptical about getting involved in the process because they, you know, aren't sure what to believe or where to go for reliable information. But I mean, it's tough. Politics is a tough business. It costs a lot of money to run a credible campaign. You know, we can have debates and arguments over whether that's good or whether that's bad, but you know, it's always been something that favors the people who have name recognition. And there's one way to, I mean, Donald Trump had never run for office before 2016, but he'd been on TV in people's living rooms for how many years? I'd go to campaign events in 2016 and be like, why are you giving this guy a chance? I mean, he's so not what a normal politician is. And that's exactly what people liked about him, right? I think that's what people, you see like a segment of the population respond to, you know, an RFK Jr. campaign that's going on right now, or some of these third parties. But, you know, there are ballot access issues for a lot of these third parties. It's hard to get on ballots in certain states because they have such a threshold for gathering signatures. And again, you can argue that it's systemic and it's something that needs to be reformed. And those are conversations that we have or cover. But it's, you know, I feel like I definitely in my reporting and in my job hear a lot of that resignation that you just had is, why do we have these same two choices again? And it's, that's reflective of who ended up voting in the primaries this time. You know, there was a lot of buzz earlier about somebody on the Democratic side rising up and challenging Joe Biden. You know, a couple people tried, but they, you know, again, there was this guy from Minnesota. He's a congressman named Dean Phillips. Most people never heard of him. It's hard to have a national profile if you're a congressman from Minnesota. For like people in Youngstown, it'd be like the new president of ISU, Bill Johnson, who used to be a congressman down there, deciding to run for president. Like nobody outside of his congressional district would know who he is. And now Bill Johnson might have made I'm speaking hypothetically because Bill Johnson was a Trump supporter, so I don't think he would have run against Donald Trump. But if he would have run in a Republican primary, he would have been, you know, nobody would have really, you know, it would have been hard for people to take a guy from, you know, Eastern Ohio seriously that they'd never heard of before just because he thought that he should be the nominee and not Donald Trump.
So speaking to, you know, you mentioned sort of name recognition as far as how Donald Trump went. And then, you know, also kind of, you know, people kind of looking for sort of the folk heroes, that sort of things. Now, we had our own, obviously, with Jim Trafficking here in Youngstown for a number of years. What sort of similarities do you see between, you know, Jim Trafficking and Donald Trump?
Well, there's a lot. And it's a great question because it's something that, like, I've, you know, talked about or written about before, and others have. And it's like there's definitely that strand of like defiant populism for both of them. You know, Trafficking, I mean, Donald Trump's, you know, a billionaire, multimillionaire, he's a celebrity, been on TV, so like Trafficking couldn't compare in that regard. But like, just when you remember the things Trafficking said and stood for when he was a congressman or even when he was a sheriff, it was very much, you know, you aren't getting what you want. You aren't getting what you deserve because of this or because of that. Really grievance politics, tapping into the disgust and disenchantment that like the working class people have. And in the Mahoning Valley back in like the mid to late 1980s, that was a really, really potent argument because the steel mills were closing. Some of them had closed completely. They weren't coming back. You know, people were underemployed, unemployed, not making as much money as they thought they should be. And we were at a time when, like, you know, the global trade trends were, you know, the United States forging these deals with other countries like Mexico, where, you know, a company could, you know, have cheaper labor somewhere other than the United States. So that was coming, that was costing jobs here in the United States. So it became a very, very potent political argument for a guy like Jim Trafficking to make. You know, he also, when he was sheriff, while all these like socioeconomic issues were going on that I just mentioned, you know, he would refuse to foreclose on people's homes who are losing their homes because they couldn't keep up with the mortgage payments. You know, and you could argue that that was a publicity stunt, but it was a pretty great publicity stunt. You know, it showed him as being like this populist who is in touch with what you know, before Bill Clinton came along a few years later, that he could really feel your pain and was willing to do something to help you. You know, Trump, and again, we can argue whether it's as authentic as Trafficants was. We can argue if Trafficants was even authentic, but Trump came along and railed against a lot of those same trade deals that Jim Trafficant didn't like. And I think the difference in time, you know, the passage of time, you know, there were a lot more places like Youngstown and the Mahoning Valley where there were voters who had seen these shifts and had, you know, felt left behind because of them and were open to somebody new, you know, coming in, presenting themselves as an outsider who wasn't gonna, you know, conform to what the system expected a typical politician to conform to. And that's, you know, that's the message that Trump won with. I mean, he also succeeded because he had, you know, this celebrity factor. But, you know, he beat up like 16 other Republicans who are all pretty well established in their political careers and who, you know, didn't, you know, people always like, well, Trump says mean things and he, you know, has these tweets and like, yeah, he does a lot of things that like maybe you or I wouldn't say or do or like, you know, but people don't care about that. They like the message they were hearing otherwise.
Do you think anything's going to actually happen to Trump after this trial? I mean, depending on what it's kind of one of those things. And it's another sort of complaint that you kind of hear, especially from the people that are very anti-Trump. But I mean, yeah, I mean, is this trial like, will anything kind of come of this? I mean, will anything prevent him from running, or is it, I mean, is that a possibility with this, or is this just sort of smoke and mirrors until it gets swept under the rug and he ends up on the ballot again, you know, come November?
You know, it's another parallel to Trafficking, right? Because he was convicted and expelled from Congress in like 2002, and he was on the ballot that year as an independent while he was in prison. He finished in third, but like there was still like 15%, I think, of 15% of the voters voted for him. You know, Trump, he's, you know, all a conviction in this current trial, like that'll, you know, well, I don't think it's going to change whether or not Trump appears on the ballot in November or whatever might happen to him in some of these other legal cases. You know, the question is like, do voters get to a point where like, okay, we're tired of this. This has been 8 years. Well, we're going on 8 years of, you know, scandal and drama every day. The question of whether or not he's going to be able to serve as president or how effectively he can serve while he's, you know, got convictions or indictments raining down on him. You know, at that point, does that start to become a more potent argument for voters who don't want to go through that? I think that in a way that's why he lost in 2020. It was like we were in the middle of this pandemic and people were like just kind of tired and exhausted, and then you had this like kind of nice sounding guy like Joe Biden who was running this whole campaign on like restoring order and normalcy. And you know, even though like both of them right now are like wholly unpopular politicians nationally, like I think people wanted a break and they thought Biden, you know, was the vote for that break to calm things down. So now it's like, okay, we've had that, but people are still unhappy. And like you mentioned, the choices are the same. So it's like, does a conviction start to like dent the mystique for Trump? Is it like, okay, we really don't want to do this for another 4 years? And I don't know. I don't, you know, we're not seeing it in the polling that it's had much of an effect so far. With Republicans, it's only reinforced their support for him, and we're a country that is very narrowly split, you know, when it comes to partisanship. So I don't know. I don't know that it'll make a difference in terms of what happens in the long run.
I got you. You know, so obviously you've been a longtime political reporter. Would you yourself ever consider getting into politics?
No. It's no, I'm happy with where I'm at, like on the other side of the fence and just writing about everybody else. And I mean, it's, you know, I think you've got to have like something in you to run. And it's why, like, I had a writing coach once who told me, like, if you want to cover politics, you can't hate politicians. Cause like, it's really easy for us to just like, for, you know, sitting at a barbecue or somewhere, be like, I hate all politicians. All politicians are crooked. And like, it's a very like easy thing to say or feel. And it's like, if you want to cover it, you can't really feel that way. Not that you have to have like sympathy for them or even like them, but you can't hate them. And I guess I've come to realize, like, you know, the people who do this have something in them that, like, good or bad, I don't know, but like, they're much stronger to like go through this than I would be, you know, have your life under a microscope, to have like the things that you think are good, like parsed in a new way, or it's like, no, that's actually bad. I don't need that. I mean, I guess you could point out the irony in me being comfortable doing that to other people when I write about them. But that's the perch where I feel most comfortable in. I like politics. I like following it. I like trying to make it relatable or sensible to people, even though I'm not always successful in doing that. So no, I'll be just fine with my name off the ballot.
Do you think this next election is going to come down to Ohio again? Is this going to be the big sort of the deciding factor? Is it going to be the deciding state, do you think?
I don't think this time, at least in the presidential race. The last two, Trump won by like 8 points, which is a pretty significant margin. I know in 2020, like the Biden campaign was really optimistic that they'd be able to like pick it up, and they were not able to do that. I feel like it could. I mean, anything could happen, especially if Trump is convicted. You know, that could change the dynamics. But what Ohio will decide is there's a Senate race here. Like the Senate right now is like 50. The Democrats have a very slim majority in the Senate, and Sherrod Brown, Ohio's Democratic senator, is up for re-election. And like, there's a Trump endorsed candidate who's running against him, Bernie Marino. It's going to be a really close race. There's going to be a lot of money spent. And I think that what happens here would like could absolutely determine which party controls the Senate. But I still think you'll see a lot from Trump and maybe a lot from Biden. Ohio is a state that they still like to come and campaign in. They'll come and campaign for Sherrod Brown and Bernie Marino. So I don't know. But I think Ohio's days as like a presidential swing state might be slipping away.
All right. So by far the most controversial question of this interview, what's the best pizza in Youngstown and why?
I was hoping you're going to ask this. So I have this debate all the time with other people that are from Youngstown or from Ohio who have passed through. But my personal favorite is Fernando's Wedgwood in Austintown. Just like as long as I can remember, it's been a family favorite. I still like the Ave, although they moved from Belmont Avenue over near Liberty to downtown, but I've had it since they moved downtown, and I still like that. And, you know, I'll mess with just about any Youngstown pizza. I don't think there's a bad one, but I Wedgwood all the way. How about you? I've got to turn this around on you now.
Yeah, we're pretty spoiled here. You know, I mean, even like a bad Youngstown pizza is better than when you go to some of these other cities where it's like, oh my gosh, this is not pizza. You know what I mean? So we're very spoiled with it. But my top three are probably Uptown, Avalon, and I would say the Elmton is probably the third.
Elmton. I like Uptown too. I think Wedgwood, Ave, and Elmton would be my top three. And then I've always heard some love for like Bellaria, which is, you know, I like, and Cornersburg. Like we could go on and on. I mean, but yeah, good choices.
So speaking, kind of on that theme too, you know, when you're back in Youngstown, are there any old familiar haunts that you're checking out when you're back here? I mean, where are kind of your go-to places when you're back visiting?
So Wedgwood, we've got our daughter, we've got our 6-year-old daughter hooked on that. You know, she knows the difference between Youngstown pizza and Cleveland pizza. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. I still like, you know, the MVR, which was like a kind of a nice laid back place to go right off campus. A lot of our old haunts on campus, though, like I think the Inner Circle's closed now. I tried to go there once. Oh gosh, where else? I feel like so many of like my favorite places like aren't open anymore, which does suck. But there have been a few new places like in the mix. What is it? There's the brewery that's like right behind, kind of near the MVR.
Penguin City.
I haven't been to that one. I've had their beer.
Noble Creature.
Yeah, I was there once. I thought that was pretty good. I'm like kind of into craft beer, and I kind of like the the different ones that Youngstown's putting out. I do like what Penguin City's doing. I've like followed one of their owners since back in the days when he was like in Gilmanterra's Party mm-hmm. Dream. There's my you know, random Youngstown reference to show everybody that I am actually from Youngstown and know a lot of random stuff. So good stuff.
Yeah, man. Richie's on. He's been down here before for a couple of different things, but we haven't done a Party Dream podcast. So I'm going to have him down, and we're going to have to talk about the old days of Gilmanterra's Party Dream. And for anybody out there watching that doesn't know, there's a documentary on them out now. But go check that out, and you'll see.
It's so good. It took me down memory lane. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Well, Henry, brother, I will let you go here, man. But thank you so very much for joining us today, man. Really, really appreciate it. And how can folks get in touch with you if they want to follow your work, if they want to just kind of keep up on what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter or X or whatever the hell it's called these days at Henry J. Gomez. I'm on NBCNews.com. Most of my work appears in writing there. Occasionally, they let this face on TV to talk about some of the stories, but. More a face for print than for TV. So
I got you. Well, Henry, again, man, thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure talking with you.
BJ, it was great. So good to see you. Thanks so much.
You too.